The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. The province of British Columbia has applied to the Canadian government to be allowed to decriminalize simple possession of some drugs. Quoting from BC's Decrim submission, quote, BC seeks to establish a cumulative binding threshold quantity at 4.5 grams, with no drug seizures, arrests, or charges for simple possession at or below this amount, end quote. They discuss the methodology which they used to come up with their weight limit. They present data from a survey conducted by the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users, VANDU, and data from research performed by Professor Corey DeBeck, PhD, from Simon Fraser University. They ignore the VANDU numbers and instead rely on the low-end figures from the range of data presented by Professor DeBeck. Yet, as they note in the report, quote, due to study limitations, including measurement limitations and the time frame of data, current to 2018 only, the researchers emphasize that the estimates produced from this methodology are conservative and expected to underestimate the current volumes of drug consumption. They are also focused on only a few classes of drugs, that is, opioids and stimulants, and thus do not provide guidance on other substances such as psychedelics, end quote. So at least to her credit, Dr. DeBeck knew that her figures were too low to be realistic. Didn't stop the province, though. And here's why. Again from the submission, quote, CPT members, partners, and stakeholders were not all aligned in their recommendations for threshold amounts. While people who use drugs, clinical experts, researchers, and Indigenous partners advocated for thresholds to be set at recommended levels based on available evidence, guiding principles, and the perspectives of people with lived experience of substance use, policing partners expressed concern that the recommended levels were too high. End quote. CPT, by the way, stands for Core Planning Table. That's the name given to the group of stakeholders who were brought together to consult on the decrim. So, to find out more about BC's proposal and where it falls short, I spoke with some of those dissenting voices.
I'm Ellie Taylor, lived experience advocate, and I'm on I Raise the Rates Coalition, VANDU, and WARS.
Hi, I'm Brittany Graham. I'm a longtime community organizer here at VANDU, the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users.
Hi, my name is Caitlin Shane. I'm a staff lawyer with Pivot Legal Society and work really closely with the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users.
I guess I could start off the conversation by saying that it's quite shocking to me that, you know, during these processes, we're allowed, you know, we're invited to these subcommittees in ways, and then there's all this ambiguous, what is the chain of command when you're on that subcommittee? And the issue with that is, you know, we ask as VANDU and as people that understand substance use and partaking in them and the positives as well as the negatives, and that understand that harm reduction isn't about being negative all the time. However, when it comes to this exact thing, they overlooked things like rural populations who have to come down and pick up large amounts of safe supply to bring it back up north, because it's actually been tested down here, because we have the equipment and the ability and the tools and resources. This is a vision I have, right? They go up and then they can then disperse it. However, if we leave it at 4.5, that means they only can pick up 4.5 of something and go up north. So we know what's going to happen then. And I mean, I can only speculate, but I'll give you my best speculation, is that that person will then go and buy either one of two things. They're going to buy a more cheaper amount where they're based up north that's more less safe because it's less expensive, literally. Or they're going to end up coming down here and realizing they can only bring that much up and being, right, and totally having people left up north withdrawing because they're a person who actually brings something safe instead of toxic substances up to them. So this is a huge gap. And as well, I see a huge gap when it comes to the fact that, you know, we know police are still involved in these conversations. We've asked from the beginning that this be a community-led endeavor. And by that, we don't mean these so-called systemic communities so much as we mean the community that is on the streets, the community that are citizens, just as much as every one of your awesome listeners out there, with the same sort of concerns and the same sort of rights. And unfortunately, I also think that we are still going to see police abusing people on the street, because at 4.5, they're still going to go through people's stuff. And hey, now the police are going to pull out scales. And what? If you have residue of fentanyl on that by accident, now you're going to jail, because fentanyl is still arrestable under this. And it's still something where it's totally left out of this conversation. It's very concerning. It's also very concerning that things like alternative ways of getting high are left out of this conversation. There are a lot of people who do other kinds of drugs, but because we're not willing to push stigma far enough, they are totally left out. And I will just say this last thing and hand it off to my esteemed colleagues. The youth are left out of this as well. And I have to tell you, that's very disturbing, because I'm seeing a lot of youth. I lead an outreach team. So we put over 270 hours a week on the streets for the last 2 years. And what I can tell you is a large population are Indigenous youth. And I have lost two young gentlemen, actually three now, who I consider nephews. This is irresponsible. And not just that, it's manslaughter to leave these things out. This will one day become something legal. And I have no question that I'll be ready to fully bring up the forces to and organize to push this so that people are not stigmatized. That's our whole point. We don't want something that only partially destigmatized. And we don't want something that partially decriminalizes. You're 4.5, now I'm at 4.7. So what? Now I'm getting arrested? And are you going to eyeball that on the street? I mean, it gets ridiculous. So those are the things that I would say are the main gaps that I've seen.
Yeah, I think you did a really good summary of our qualms with this decriminalization. And I think the big thing here is we have 6 people a day in BC dying of overdoses. We have 19 people and counting a day across the entire country. We need bold moves when it comes to drug policy right now. And this wasn't a bold move. It was, the safer option. It was better than what we saw with the city, but, barely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's why we refer to it as a small step, tiny step. That's a very powerful word, right? Small.
Just so that I know that I'm getting this straight, Vancouver has also put forward its own, or is putting forward its own request to decriminalize that's separate from BC. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. They put in one this summer. The decriminalization for the city of Vancouver, and then the one that went in last week would be for our entire province. So our provincial government sent an exemption request to the federal government.
So it's unclear how the two exemptions will interact and whether they can coexist. When Vancouver submitted it, decriminalization didn't really seem to be part of the province's plan. So Vancouver just said, we're going to go it alone. Shortly after Vancouver announced that it was going to decriminalize or seek to decriminalize within the city, I suspect the province probably felt some pressure and made its own announcement that they were also going to submit an application. So given, how slowly things move over at Health Canada, Vancouver hasn't received a response yet as to whether its application for an exemption will be approved. And now we're in a situation where we have 2 applications in at the same time. So it remains to be seen. It's within the discretion of Health Canada. So they might say something like, okay, scratch Vancouver's application. We're just doing the BC application, and that's going to include everyone in BC, including Vancouver. Or they might do something where it's like in Vancouver, the Vancouver model applies. So that remains to be seen.
Are they similar the with the 4.5 grams and such, or are they different kinds, or are they proposing different things?
I would argue they're actually quite similar. If you were talking with the BC government, they would say that it's more, but it's sort of more in which way. So the like city version is that they laid it out that each drug had a different amount that could be carried. So like 2 grams of this, 1 gram of this, et cetera. And when you add it all up, it's, you know, between 5 and 9 grams that someone could be carrying at a given time, where the BC ministry version is 4.5 grams cumulative, where you can carry any amount of drugs that, as long as it adds up to 4.5 grams, then that is okay. But if you break it down, it ends up being like 1 gram for this or 2 grams for that. So it's, you know, very similar. But they feel like it's better. I think the one good thing that's from both of them is that mandatory referrals isn't included. So people aren't forced into treatment or forced into the system. So hopefully that continues if it gets through Health Canada. Mm.
Oh, and I would want to mention that's something we have to push too when it comes to youth. That's really connected, because that's something that we can follow up on as well in terms of connecting that.
Let's talk about youth now. You would say this is a 19-year age limit too, so people who are 18 or younger are still going to be subject to criminal sanctions and whatever the proposal. Yeah?
Yeah, we were told by the BC Ministry of Mental Health and Addictions that in phase two, they would look into the youth file. Our concerns are around the fact that politically in the last 2 years, there have been bills brought to the government around mandatory treatment for youth when they have an overdose or something like that. So, you know, when we're bringing it up now, it's really to push that, like, this is a population of people who use drugs, and just because they aren't of age doesn't mean they aren't participating in drug use. And lots of people have examples of being criminalized in their youth.
And I'd like, Ellie, here, and I'd like to add to that, that when it comes to this issue, it's very important to understand that this is, I think part of it too, is that, you know, it's kind of like the idea of why they didn't put fentanyl there is that, you know, they want to make one move. They want to get something. We want this movement to go somewhere right now. We've got all this emergencies, right? So the idea is kind of take the more controversial, more radical, and make that into phase two, right? So, however, though, how many youth are going to die from overdoses between now and phase two? So that's my first question. And the second question, how many of those youth are going to die of fentanyl overdoses? I mean, come on. I know it's really we all don't want to think that kids are using drugs, but the answer, or substances, but the answer is this. Absolutely, right? My kids took up the same stuff I use. I'd probably be a little upset too, to be honest, right? Because, you know, that's just a stigma. I know y'all added that, by the way. However, it is our responsibility to challenge that stigma in ourselves and others. So here's the thing. Yeah, it's controversial to create some kind of harm reduction for youth. However, how many youth are going to die? How many more moms to mom stop the harm? I've talked to Leslie McBain about this. She agrees with that. You know, like, just because they're youth doesn't mean we can't. And they think, okay, it's too controversial. We don't want to do it because it could screw up. But how many lives, and when I'm talking harm reduction, I'm about the lives. I'm not about the money. How many lives are going to be lost? How many more kids are going to be hiding in alleyways or going into rides that are unsafe or sleeping in places that are unsafe? Sorry, it really bothers me because I was one of those youth. I was kicked out when I was 14. And I had to make my own way in this life. So, and I'm Indigenous and trans and part Chinese as well. So it hasn't been easy. But I'm not going to say it's as hard as for Black trans. You get my point, though. This is not the time, like Brittany said, to not make, you know, we have to be bold. Bold is including the children in this vision. Bold is including the elders. Bold is making a plan which gets in the door, sets up, and then makes a new way. We're not looking for more kids to use substance. And that's one of their arguments. If you put, even make this legal, the kids are going to use it. No, come on. They said that about everything, right? They said that about cigarettes, said about alcohol. They say that about TV. They say it about video games. They say it about movies. They say it about music. And I'd like to also say, at what point does anyone have the right to say what I'm putting in my body? That's autonomy. And that's protected by the UN Charter of Rights.
Yeah. And I think another thing to point out is if those bills that they have previously mentioned come back. So it was Bill 22 in the provincial government that was about mandatory referrals for youth. It's like basically like if you have an overdose at 18 or 17, you might be forced into this system that exists and you might not want to be in it. And there's lots of research that shows that being forced into treatment or detox or whatever can really mess people up and actually cause more harm than good. Or if you're 19 or 20 and you have the same scenario, you don't necessarily have that happening to you. So why are we creating two systems and possibly creating an entire generation of people who are criminalized, which we already have those generations. We have people who with lived experience who've said, this me up, this really hurt my life and I cannot support that happening to young people. And so we got to stop listening to scared people who are scared of drugs, who are just scared of drugs because it's been 100 years of prohibition. And we just need to start listening to people who use drugs and their own personal experiences on creating those policies.
That was part of a conversation with Caitlin Shane, staff lawyer at Pivot Legal Society, Ellie Taylor, coordinator, Raise the Rates, and Brittany Graham, acting executive director, EIDGE program coordinator, and community developer with VANDU. We'll have more from that discussion on next week's show. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Staying with British Columbia, I caught up with Eris Nix from the Drug User Liberation Front recently to get an update on DULF's efforts to set up a compassion club through which people who use drugs could get a safe supply of drugs. First, let's start with the compassion club, the application for an exemption that you're seeking from Health Canada to start a compassion club. What's happening with that? Can you give me an update?
Nothing. We've sent them two letters now being like, please respond or we're going to sue you. That's where we're at. I can't remember if it was you I was talking to about this earlier, but I don't think we'll see any forward movement on approving our Section 56 exemption unless they also approve our SUOP. Like, I have a feeling they'll kind of sit on their hands until they approve both documents. Canada's parliament just turned over in that snap election. So now there's a new minister of health and blah, 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 blah. So all the documents we sent to the previous minister of health, we have to resend to the new guy, you know. Well, ostensibly, it's like the government can just be like, well, we're trying, you know, it's a bit chaotic over here. So I think us trying to like snap sue them right now would be the wrong decision. But if we certainly don't hear back, like even, hey, we're thinking about it. We'll probably, you know, ramp things up in December. But it's no forward movement whatsoever. I guess on the ground, however, though, I should say this, like we will do the exact same project illicitly, you know, if we can't do it legally. So no matter what happens, a project will happen. I just far rather do it above board and with, you know, licit drugs than illicit drugs.
Absolutely. The threat of arrest would probably, I presume, be a little less if it's done.
Well, yeah, and it would just be way easier to get the heroin. I'm like, right now we're having kind of the two dark web markets we were using for our last couple of events shut down. So we've had to switch, you know, who we're buying off of and where we're getting it and blah, 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 blah. So there's like a bit of a hiccup on that end. And there's kind of like a bit. You know, I'm disconcerted that, you know, if you have a 200-person program, and even if everyone on that program was using 1 gram of drugs per week, which is a very conservative estimate, I'm like, that's 200 grams of heroin a week, or cocaine or whatever, you know. I'm like, that's a lot of drugs. Like, an ounce is 28 grams. It's like, you know, 10 ounces, whatever, 7 ounces or whatever.
No, supply chain and cost and everything else, that's it's a serious endeavor. So BC's Safer Supply, the I can't believe it's not really safe supply, Safer Supply. Is that still operating, or is that?
I mean, I'm still on it. For folks on opiate or opioid replacement, a lot of people are getting cut off from their carries of Dilaudid. I'm not sure if we were talking before or after Crosstown cut off everyone's carries of heroin. You know, basically, I'm like, your doctor wouldn't prescribe you scotch. Why would your doctor prescribe you opioids? You know, I'm like, the whole system is up because it doesn't make any sense. I'm like, your doctor's there to make sure you're healthy. You know, drugs are there so you can have fun, but that, you know, there's a Faustian wager when you do them. So putting everything into this medical system, and this is why I disagree with the statement. You know, people are like, drugs aren't a criminal issue, they're a medical issue. And I'm like, drugs aren't a medical issue, they can be a social issue, maybe, you know. And they are a social issue right now because of prohibition. But the medical system, the medicalization of safe supply is like really failing. And nobody can access it. Nobody's willing to prescribe it. You know, if you go anywhere outside of Vancouver, which is already bad, doctors are like, you know, calling each other out basically to the colleges. If someone's prescribing Dilaudid, another doctor will come in and be like, you can't do that. That's going to kill people, and lodging complaints, and people are getting strikes on their record. And it's like, I'll try and tone down this swearing, but it's a real nightmare is what I'm getting at. And it's like a totally ineffective intervention.
And this is the thing too. I mean, for years, you know, a lot of reformers have been talking about it this way, and it's, I mean, in Canada, at least you have a health system where people can get access to physicians a little more easily than we do down here in the United States. I mean, cost barriers are significant, and you know, finding a physician who can prescribe.
I think, you know, if you look at Dulles perspective, it's like the difference between a prison reform and prison abolition. We're not trying to reform the prohibitionist system. We're trying to abolish it. So, and I do think there's an important, like when you're talking about what folks in the States want, you know, people who don't have access to things want things, you know, even if they're ineffective interventions. And I think we see this even in Canada. People are like, oh, we need a FTIR machine. I'm like, the FTIR machine is very, it's not like worth the money of investing the $100,000 in a machine that's going to give you potential contents of your drugs with like an extreme inaccuracy, you know? So it's like, what we really need is like mass systemic drug policy reform. And I think that's what we're advocating for. And anything less than that is not something I'm willing to, you know, I'll put my support behind progressive steps, but I do understand that at the end of the day, they're not going to get anything done unless you reform the entire system, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Don't settle for what you're given. It's like the book, Eyes on the Prize, right? Keep going toward the actual goal rather than just settling. And that's, I'm glad
to hear. It takes a specific kind of person to be willing to take on the risk at the end of the day. And I think, you know, that ends up being us. Which is fine. I'm like, you know, it is whatever. But I'm like, I don't want to give people the illusion that things are good in Canada. They're really bad. And I just ran this celebration of life for this 28-year-old kid that just passed away. You know, absolutely brutal. And I'm like, I knew two other people that died of overdoses over the weekend. It's just like, people are getting blown away. Even with all these health-oriented interventions, people are getting blown away by like a deregulated market, and a deregulated market that's becoming worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. Yesterday, I got a notification that someone brought cocaine to get tested at the FTIR, and it was all, I don't know how to pronounce it, but like fluazepine or something, like the benzo. Like it was just a bag full of benzo dust, but they got sold cocaine, which I'm like, what the hell? You know, I'm like, could you imagine you're at a party and you're just like, yeah, going to do a line of coke, pour it out, and then your head hits the table as soon as he snorted, because he just snorted the line of benzos. Well, I'm like, this is what happens when you let a market, you know, continue to be deregulated and deregulated and deregulated and deregulated and deregulated. And you stomp the supply and you stomp the supply and you arrest people, which I guess brings us to the question about whether decriminalization will be a successful intervention, right? And here are my thoughts on that. I'm like, the government is like, well, it hasn't even passed. So let's be clear on that. The government of BC asked the federal government to decriminalize possession of 4.5 grams of heroin, methamphetamine, and crystal meth. This is something I'm not extremely clear on. When they say heroin, I'm not sure if they mean fentanyl or if they mean actual heroin. So if you have fentanyl, are they still going to arrest you? They're not asking for decriminalization of other drugs such as psychedelics. So, ketamine's not on that list, or LSD, or these kinds of things, right? And then I'm like, even if you can possess drugs, if you can't buy them from somewhere safe, you're still going to get drugs that kill you. So this thing that's being lauded as like the thing that's going to stop the overdose crisis just means that, the orientation of police will shift away from potentially people on the street up to higher in the supply chain, which is going to wreck more chaos and cause more violence, right? If you start arresting higher up drug dealers, you're going to end up with a turf war. And I'm already also like, this is really important too. It's like nobody where I live in Vancouver is getting arrested for simple possession of those quantities of drugs. Nobody. I've never heard about it happening. It's always possession with intent. And so long as, if the drugs, I know someone that got arrested for having a gram of crack flapped up into points, so 0.1 grams, 10 of them. He bought the crack for personal use, but the police arrested him and were like, this is possession with intent to traffic, right? So he only had 1 gram, but because of how the drugs were packaged, he was arrested for potentially trafficking drugs, and I had to write the dude this long court support letter and all that to get him off, to be like, that's not what happened. He works for me. I'm just like, this isn't going to do any, this is a way for the police to pat themselves on the back. It's a way for civic politicians to look like they're doing something. It's a way for the provincial politicians to look like they're doing something. But at the end of the day, it's all a crock, So I support the idea, but I'm just like, you have no way of people to access clean drugs that don't kill them. If you go after people higher up on the supply chain, you're just going to cause chaos and violence and potentially make the supply chain worse. Like, you don't know if there are stable people trafficking drugs and their supply is pretty constant. If you pull them out and someone goes in, like, you don't know the way that person is going to behave in the market, right? So I'm just like, the whole thing is just like, it's a ridiculous sham and a farce. And I'm like, it's cool that you guys are decriminalizing simple possession. Like, I don't think there should be any law, though. It doesn't go far enough. Again, it's reform versus abolition.
That was part of a conversation with Eris Nix from the Drug User Liberation Front in Vancouver, British Columbia. We'll hear more on next week's show. And for now, folks, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.